Bo.
Everybody's smoking, and no one's getting high. Everybody's flying, and never touch the sky. There's UFOs over New York, and I ain't too surprised.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me that this is like
Good evening. We live in strange days.
Indeed.
He's Mike Woods, a UFO guy.
And he's Errol Bruce Knapp, moderator of one of the premier email lists on the internet, UFO Updates.
Welcome, listeners here in Toronto and around the world via the World Wide Web and on 60-70 kilohertz in the 49-meter band, shortwave, to the intriguing phenomena of unidentified flying objects.
Tonight on Strange Days, indeed.
Mysterious lights seen over Hamilton, Ontario.
Ball of light reportedly morphs into three aliens.
And a brightly lit UFO hovers over a Georgia home.
And a green cylinder UFO sighted over Dublin.
Those and other stories.
Along with our guest tonight, UFO physical trace researcher Ted Phillips, and you on the phones, make for Strange Days indeed.
But first, this week's UFO news and updates. Winston B. reported last week that on Monday, April 24th, one of his colleagues at work, who's into astronomy, was on the road making a delivery when he noticed a strange light in the sky over Hamilton, which, for listeners around the world, is a large city located precisely 47 miles or 78 kilometers southwest of Toronto.
As this object flew over, the colleague realized that there were, in fact, three lights in formation, looking like satellites and making no noise. They were in a triangular formation moving across the night sky, most likely in a polar orbit, past Polaris, the North Star, and fading out fast.
And the lights were fairly well spread out but maintained their triangular formation. Our thanks to Aaron Warner and Joe Trainer of the UFO Roundup for this report. Now, you may recall that
back on 11th of September last year, we reported a similar story. Rob Murdoch and four friends were camping in Balsam Lake Provincial Park near Cobequid in Ontario on the night of September the 3rd. At 11:17 p.m., Rob and his friends saw, moving from north to south, at a speed that was too fast to be a satellite. Rob then noticed two other lights, one higher than the other, forming, with the first light, a triangle shape.
At around midnight on the 5th of September, Douglas Edwards saw three bright white lights in a triangular shape moving in a south-southeasterly direction. And he watched them for about 15 seconds until the lead light disappeared, followed moments later by the other two, he said.
Now, our old friend Nick Velasquez of York University did some quick checking immediately after the two sightings last year by surfing to the German Space Operations Center website. Nick checked to see if any satellites would have been over Cobequid, Ontario, or Joe's Lake, Michigan. And according to the GSOC satellite predictions, there were no satellites in the skies over either Rob's or Douglas's areas at the times of their sightings.
But apparently, so they say, the United States Navy, which has satellites up there, fly in clusters of three, and apparently there are three sets of three up there.
Which open you up for a lot of nighttime sighting, because that's one of the neat things up north is watching the satellites cruise by in that nice, straight, steady arc.
Now, Mary of Weartown, New Jersey, a strange story, reports that last week both of her daughters came running downstairs from their bedrooms crying that there was a ball of light floating around their rooms and that it turned into three aliens.
Now, Mary's response, she started reading the gospel to try and calm her daughters. Both girls do not believe in UFOs. They were very upset and told her they will deny it if she tells anyone.
Mary says her 10-year-old cried for a couple of hours. The older daughter had been complaining of something behind her ear, and Mary says she could only feel a tiny lump.
Mary also has a tiny lump on her neck. When she tried to dig it out, she got frightened. Mary's 10-year-old gets terrible headaches and does not sleep much because she's afraid, but she will not discuss it.
The 10-year-old told Mary that the light turned into three little gray beings. Mary had told them repeatedly no one wants to hear about it, that if they think there is a ghost or entity, etc., etc., keep on saying, Jesus is my Savior, I only worship him and no other.
Well, Mary's been reading the Bible and UFO books. She says the Bible indicates to her that aliens are really devils in disguise. Mary also said she thinks there's a war among aliens to get control of Earth because some ET species are becoming extinct and need our reproductive capabilities. She doesn't believe them when the Greys say that they are making a new breed of perfect hybrids that are, to quote her, all-loving. Her children used to listen to and pray with her, but now they don't want to touch either subject, and God knows, Mary says, she's really giving it her all.
Georgia State Director Tom Sheets reports that the National UFO Reporting Center, New Fork in Seattle and MUFON of Georgia, are investigating a May 2nd close encounter with a brightly lit disc.
Peter Davenport, the director at New Fork, received a call from a credible Marietta, Georgia citizen regarding a disc that was observed through a skylight during the night of May 2nd. On May 3rd, Mufunga, field investigators Olivia Newton, and I love these acronyms, don't you?
Yeah.
You know? Olivia Newton and Michael Hitt interviewed the witness, who was found to be very credible with many years devoted to work in church ministry.
It sounds a little less rude if you say MUFON GA, I think. The witness woke sometime between 3 and 5 a.m. on May 2nd and saw through a skylight a brightly lit disc over her home. The disc was gray metallic with a grouping of steady red and white lights on the bottom, something like headlights. And as she watched, the craft tipped up on its side and revealed that the edge had three triangular-shaped window-like structures. They were rotating in a clockwise direction. Light was also coming through the triangular windows, but was not as bright as the lights on the bottom of the disc. The craft was over trees that surround the clearing around her home, and she said that she also heard a faint whirring sound.
Well, as she watched, the craft descended down over her home until it all but completely filled the view from her skylight, leaving a few inches on one edge. The lights were intensely bright, lighting up the area like daylight. The UFO then moved over the house away from the skylight toward the northeast. The bright glare from the light lessening until it was gone. No electromagnetic effects were noticed, but the witness indicated that she was so focused on the event that she felt as if she could not move. And, of course, hubby slept on.
Investigators Newton and Hitt estimate that the craft was about 25 feet in diameter, and the witness agreed to make a sketch of the craft, and photos were taken of the inside of her house. There's a prominent congressman in Georgia who is well aware of the hundreds of UFO sightings that have occurred in Georgia over the past 5 years. So says John Thompson in an email to George Filer's files. This same congressman has a trusted friend who has seen UFOs and let the congressman know about them in detail. And yet, the congressman seemingly has no interest in UFOs and associated phenomena. MUFON of Georgia has met this same congressman and presented copies of UFO investigations done in his district, including one with the congressman's friend.
And of course, it's easy, though, to understand why the critter here in question isn't interested in UFOs, and that's because there are no aliens registered to vote. In an unrelated case, a photo of a UFO and its positive analysis was presented to the congressman. The congressman has acknowledged to MUFON in private that he knows the esteemed retired law enforcement officer who saw this UFO, supplied the photo to MUFON. The same photo was examined by an off-duty FBI photo analyst who declared it to be a, quote, genuine unknown, end quote.
John Thompson continued in his email to Filer's Files, it's a hard road UFO investigators must pave. 50 years of tireless labor still have not lanced the fear of the giggle factor. Nothing, even trusted and well-respected individuals a congressman acknowledges as his equal, can induce America's political leaders to consider that an unknown alien intelligence is toying with mankind's evolution.
Now, there is no genuine overt interest or displays of profiles encouraged by our congressional representatives, our being written by an American citizen, I might point out, regarding UFOs. Indeed, instead, the public acknowledgement of UFOs by elected U.S. leaders is so low that it has to be wondered if an invasion was announced by the media, if any would have the courage to take immediate action to protect America. Make no mistake about it, aliens are here, according to John Thompson, and they're doing more than just scooting around. No proof that our reality and current technology can decipher. Millions of sightings and covert abductions point to a more dangerous and subtle invasion. Mr. Thompson says they appear to be shaping man's destiny in our culture as it suits alien intelligence for its own sinister purposes. Millions are not wrong on what they believe they are seeing or experiencing.
And he closes with, a giant among elected U.S. representatives needs to step forward. Such a leader could be the Georgia congressman who cares about the security and welfare of the United States, and if so, he must act quickly, as time is not on humanity's side. Abductions are the dark heart of the threat to explore and hold public hearings on. The rest is only distraction and tricks. Half a century of misconceptions and fool's errands that only offer proof is not proof. They are establishing control as we squabble over the details of our defeat. Hefty stuff from John Thompson, and our thanks to John Thompson and George Filer for the food for thought. Some odd news this week, including this one, which is a classic Irish.
Gary Muggen was listening to the radio at his home in Ballinteer, a suburb of Dublin, Ireland, when he spotted strangeness in the sky.
He saw a cylindrically shaped light green glowing object. It passed over his house and paused momentarily. And as he watched the object, the radio that he was listening to stopped working. The object then took off at an amazing speed without a sound and disappeared over nearby mountains. How apt that it's green.
I'm just thinking that if it was cylindrically shaped and brown, I would think it was a floating can of Guinness, you know, and we'd all be giving chase at this point. Now, witness Gary Muggen estimated later that the UFO was about 80 foot or 12 meters long and flew at about 50 miles an hour, which is not even liftoff speed for a Cessna 150, and that it took off at the speed of a supersonic jet, so it had great acceleration.
He immediately called the radio talk show at 104.4 FM in Dublin and told them about it. And the host's reaction was not reported in the article. This story comes from, and our thanks to Joe Trainer of UFO Roundup for a little late for St. Paddy's Day, I think.
Yeah, I think so, too.
April 15th, at 1:09 p.m., a witness reports that he and friends were fishing off the pier at Montauk Point, Long Island, in the early afternoon when he saw a blazing light flash in the sky, and he spotted three disc-shaped objects hovering 20 feet above the Atlantic Ocean.
Now, the witness reports it seemed there were windows in the craft, but he's not positive. The discs were spinning in very tight circles for about 5 minutes and then plunged into the water. And as they hit the water, there was no splash. The witness said that it was as if there were an opening in the ocean and it just swallowed them up.
Now, thanks to George Filer and Peter Davenport of the National UFO Reporting Center for that one. UFOs have often been observed entering and leaving the water. And, of course, the most famous case, Mike, is the one that happened off Shag Harbor in Nova Scotia. That was the night of October 4th, 1967, when a large, unidentified, lighted object over 60 feet in diameter descended from the sky in front of a number of boats, including a Coast Guard vessel with RCMP officers on board.
As the object slowly sank beneath the waves, the boat rushed to the scene of the landing, only to find a thick yellow foam on the surface at the apparent point of impact. Now, the Royal Canadian Navy sent a team of divers to search the sea bottom, but gave up after 4 days, having found nothing.
And curiously enough, civil and military authorities confirmed that no aircraft were missing. And 33 years later, the incident is still a mystery, drawing UFO documentary makers from around the world to interview witnesses and look for clues. And Don Ledger, who was a guest here last year, also a flying kind of guy like Mike Woods, covered the case extensively in his recent book, Maritime UFO Files, a good book, a good opportunity to plug it, too. Because
absolutely, and a good book for those interested in getting a real insight on the UFO, Canadian UFO scene, of which there is a considerable amount of information to look at.
Yeah, and unfortunately, there aren't too many, although Chris Rutkowski has a book
out. Chris Rutkowski.
And some of the classic books that you might like to get your hands on if you really can. UFO Canada by Yurko Bunderchuk. You can find copies of that in various used bookstores, except that people who own used bookstores have suddenly realized the value of UFO books. Our guest is considered to be the world's leading expert on physical traces found at alleged UFO landing sites. In the last 30 years now, he's personally investigated over 500 UFO reports. And in 1975, he compiled the Physical Trace Catalog, which was published by the Center for UFO Studies, and a revised edition last year, which contains over 2,200 events from over 5,000 cases representing alleged UFO landings in 79 countries. He believes that after over 30 years of investigation, the data indicates a non-terrestrial origin to the UFO phenomena.
His credentials are as follows: Director of the Center for Physical Trace Research, a research associate, J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies, staff member of the Mutual UFO Network, MUFON, Physical Trace Advisor, National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, NICAP, Field Engineer, Minuteman Missile Project, participant, Vanguard Satellite Tracking Program, and the author of numerous scientific papers and physical traces associated with UFO sightings.
Joining us on the line from his home near Branson, Missouri, which is the perfect place to live, because Ted is also a lifelong drummer, is the world's foremost expert on UFO physical traces, Ted Phillips. Ted, good evening.
Hi, from Branson, Missouri.
And home of all of those wonderful theaters and showbiz.
Yes, and lots of traffic.
Ted, the cliche that we always ask our guests when they first join us at the top of the 90 minutes is, how did you get involved in all of this, and what led you to investigating physical trace cases? In ten words or less, Ted.
And we're counting.
Okay. I actually became interested in flying saucers by listening to Frank Edwards on the Mutual radio network back in the late 40s as a very young child. Mm-hmm. And my father was working at a radio station with a guy who was the news director there. And during World War II, he was a bomber pilot, and the entire complement of bombers witnessed an object that flew over the bombers, reversed direction, and flew under the bombers. And the bombers were actually rocked by the shock wave as this thing went by. And after talking to him, even though I was only like 9 years old, I was really hooked. And so I continued to read and keep up with it. And I've been heavy into astronomy my entire life. And so in 1964, I started looking into some really interesting cases in Missouri just on my own. And I put together reports on each of the events. Mm-hmm. And in early 1968, I learned of a case that was way beyond me. And that was here in Missouri, three hunters saw in daylight an object 300 feet away and took two photos of it. Right. And had $600 worth of camping equipment destroyed by a beam or something from this thing.
Really?
A very, very high-powered case. And so I thought, well, what am I going to do with this? So I took a chance, and I called Northwestern University. And sure enough, I get on the line, Dr. J. Allen Hynek, and I tell him what I've got. He says, well, I'm coming down to Columbia to give a lecture, in about 2 weeks, get the witness and the negatives, and let's get together, which we did. And Alan took the negatives back to Chicago with him for analysis, and he took copies of all the reports that I had checked private or had investigated privately. And about 2 weeks later, he called, invited the wife and I to come up, and we spent a couple of days up there with he and Bill Powers. And Alan asked me to join his little group. And at the end of 1968, over dinner, he suggested that it was time that we stop chasing everything that flew and start specializing. And he said, you know, I think the most potentially rewarding area would be what people claim are landing sites,
mm-hmm.
because there's some kind of physical residue there. So I started scouring all of the historical documents, and when I gave my first lecture at the first MUFON conference as a mere child, I had, I believe it was 57 cases, and everybody thought that was pretty spectacular.
Now, when you say as a mere child, how old were you?
Well, a little beyond a mere child, I guess.
But you must have been pretty darn young to have run into Alan Hynek at that stage.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, Alan and I were extremely close for, well, until he passed away, for mm-hmm. 20 years. We went to a lot of landing sites together and were in constant touch by phone, and it was just great. And when we lost Alan, it really took the fun out of the whole thing, because he and I had such great times calling each other when we got spectacular news, and all of a sudden he wasn't there to call. And so mm-hmm. I dropped out of the whole business. And
I'm just going to do a little quick backgrounder here for some of our listeners. J. Allen Hynek is considered still the dean of UFO researchers and the man who coined the standard close encounter of the first, second, third kind, and is considered a pivotal figure in UFO research, took it out of the ghetto and made it adhere to normal scientific principles.
And he was in the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind,
yes.
Wasn't he? He was the goateed man with the glasses.
Exactly.
I'm sure everybody's seen this.
Yeah, he had a much bigger part. He was kind of disappointed. He had.
Oh, he ended up on the cutting room floor.
Yeah, Spielberg had him falling to his knees. And then Spielberg thought, well, this is maybe a little degrading.
Yeah, great.
But Alan liked it, so.
I just wanted to go back to that story that you told off the top of the beam coming down and burning camping gear up, Ted.
Mm-hmm.
So what was the conclusion that was come to? It was a beam that came down from a UFO and burned up the camping gear?
Well, that's a plausible explanation. The problem we had was the primary witness, who always would drag a camera around with him when he was deer hunting, was at that time a state official, and he's now a rather high state official.
Oh.
And he wishes not to be identified. So this was way back in 1966 that this happened, and it took me almost 2 years to track him down. And we had to have a vow of secrecy as far as his name and so on. Mm-hmm. And so it's a case we really have not talked about that much. The photograph is very good. Fred Beckman analyzed the negatives, which were 2.25-inch format negatives out of an old twin lens Arcoflex.
Ooh,
yeah, they were
nice
quite
image,
good.
Though.
And there are some tree branches on one side in the image, and then there are two dead trees that are sticking up from the bottom. Well, one of those dead trees, when the hunters went back to the campsite, they saw this plume of smoke. They arrived at the campsite, and there was $600 worth of cots and record players and radios and tent and everything else just gone. The interesting thing was the aluminum cots inside the tent were melted, as was all the equipment in there, but the ground was very dry. Of course, in November, and the leaves were quite dead and dry, hanging all above the tent. They were not even seared. And the tent poles, which were externally positioned, were not even singed. They weren't hurt at all. So it was a very concentrated effect. And as they're standing there going through the remnants, they hear a humming sound, and they look up to the north, and about 300 feet away, this object is ascending at about a 20-30 degree angle, and as it ascends, the guy grabbed his camera, which is around his neck, and shoots the first photo. And in this photo, you can see the tree. It's about 15 feet tall, and it's about 15 feet from the campsite, and it was burning at the top, only at the top. And it was almost directly in front of the object as it took off. So the assumption was as the object went in, something happened between it and the campsite that ignited the treetop and destroyed the camping equipment. He took two photos. The object was picking up speed by the second one. That's quite blurred. But the first one shows very distinctly a disc-shaped object with some sort of raised structure on the front and a sort of circular tower which has an opening in the top with a kind of like a whip antenna device coming out of the center of that tower.
Excuse me for interrupting here, Ted. This sounds a lot like the craft that was grabbed in the Trent photos. Didn't that have a central antenna-type mast on it?
And no, this thing looks nothing like that. On the Trent photos, the tower is in the center of the object. On this, it's near the rear top section. And the little tower structure is kind of slanted back towards the rear of the object. And there's some sort of indentation in the actual body surface right behind this tower structure. I've done as much enhancement as I can do, and I sent Bruce McAbee a copy of this thing.
Uh-huh.
And so he and I are going to be together up in Canada in July. And
oh, that's right. That's in Alberta?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. St. Paul, I
think. St. Paul, right. Yeah. The world's only official UFO landing pad.
Absolutely. I'm anxious to see that.
Uh-huh. Well, there's a lot of good speakers going to be there. There's yourself and McAbee and Chris Rutkowski, Stan Friedman.
Yeah, Stanton and I go way too far back. He's the best speaker I think I've ever heard on the subject of UFOs.
Yeah, Stan is amazing. The folks over at Canada AM, a national TV show, Coast to Coast in the mornings here, love to have him on because he gets 2 minutes and he jams 6.5 minutes worth of information, and you ask him one question and he goes.
Oh, you bet he does.
And he's almost impossible. It's almost a fade to black on Stan.
Yes.
Get him out of there. But he does have some incredible material, as do you, of cases of physical evidence. Let's get down to the traces here, Ted. What would you say is the typical physical trace?
Well, there appear to be three basic types, first of all, of objects that generate the traces, and three primary types of sites that are found. The sites really have reached a point, as far as I'm concerned, where they're almost like UFO fingerprints, because you get quite a variety of objects, but yet they are relatively consistent when you look at the description by the witnesses and how they are interpreting what they have seen. What I found a long time ago is always have the witnesses sketch the thing, because you're standing there thinking you understand what they're describing. And the problem is they have nothing to relate it to. And so they can't say, well, it was like a 747. The first type of object, which is, to me, the most interesting, really, are the very small objects. For example, a meter in diameter up to about 3 meters in diameter, seen at very, very close range. Typically, they don't land. They don't actually touch the surface, but they hover about a foot or two above the ground, generating a circular or donut or ring sort of trace. And those particular type of objects, the very small ones, also generate primarily the most interesting type of trace, which is a dehydrated ring. In other words, the soil and the plants are totally sapped of all moisture. And in some instances, the site will be luminous for anywhere from a couple of days to 4 days to perhaps as long as a week, and glowing rather brilliantly.
Really?
Yes, yes.
Day and night, presumably?
Well, not day.
No?
No, it's not quite that bright. But uh-huh. One of the very best cases I've ever investigated was out in Kansas. And I just finished the report on that, which didn't take too long. It happened in 1971, and I just finished the report. So
It's another about, rush to judgment in the UFO community. Oh, well.
Absolutely. Well, believe it or not, I was getting some new information on that case right up until the end of last year. And the entire report is, I don't know, 600 and some odd pages long. And a lot of analysis from laboratories like Nottingham University and Oak Ridge and Los Alamos and Battelle and so on, and they all found the soil to be radically different from the control soil, the normal soil, in the center of this thing and around it. We should talk about that one in some depth, because it is a tremendously interesting case, and it's one of the top dozen of the 2,000 plus events. It's a typical site for that, for the type 1 object. Mm-hmm. And I call that then the type 1 trace. And right now I'm in the process of trying to classify the types of objects that leave certain specific types of residue and so on. This case took place out in north central Kansas. The case has just everything you want in a very high quality UFO event. The witness was a 16-year-old farm boy. He was tending his sheep, having arrived home late with his parents, and he was out in the dark sheep pen feeding the sheep, which was a school project that he had. And his mother, after some period of time, calls to him from the back porch of the house, which is a couple hundred feet away, calls him to supper, and he sort of screams back that he'll be there as soon as he's finished. And as soon as he says that, he hears a rumbling sound behind a hog shed about 40 feet from him. This noise he likened to an old washing machine that's out of balance. And he steps slightly around the edge of the sheep shed, and this thing lights up. It's an object about 8 to 10 feet in diameter, about 5 feet thick, and it's hovering about 5 feet above the ground under some trees in a shelter belt area. This thing is brilliant. It's multicolored. It's changing colors all the time. Difficult to look at. It's so bright. But the important thing is, at the base of the object, there is a sort of shimmery down spray that's coming out of the bottom of the object, a luminous spray, and it seems to stop about a foot above the ground. And on the ground, he could see a light haze or fog in a circular pattern on the surface of the ground, maybe a couple of inches high. He can't move. He wanted to run, and the dog was standing there, didn't make a sound. The sheep were all standing still and very quiet. And after a fair period of time, we're not really sure how long, several minutes, the object suddenly sort of rocked to the left, and the downloading spray became much brighter, much more intense, and the glow of the object more intense, and it took off down between the trees, made a right-hand turn, started up over, rising over the hog shed, a large hog shed, and at that point the sound changed to a high-pitched whistling, and the boy lost his vision. He couldn't see anything. He could hear the sound of the thing receding slowly to the south, and again, after a period of perhaps a minute, he began to regain his vision, saw the object in the south over the farmhouse, ran in, got his parents, they ran out, they saw it. I found two witnesses, one a police officer 10 miles south who saw a very brilliant object flying over from the Delphos area over his town of Minneapolis at just the right time, at the time of ascent, and a high school principal who had seen an object going into, generally, the Delphos area prior to the observation. So at any rate, he and his parents stand there looking at this thing, and it's circular, and it's large, and it's very bright. He's telling them how close this thing was. It was 40 feet away from him. So they run around the hog shed, and this is a totally dark area. It's a shelter belt. And there they find, along the flight path, evidently it came in the same way it went out, a tree 7 inches in diameter, which had been knocked to the ground along the incoming flight path.
Was that uprooted or was it?
No, it was broken off a foot above the ground.
Oh.
Where the object had been hovering, as they walk around into this dark area past this fallen tree, they see an 8-foot ring of soil that is glowing so brightly that they all said you could read a newspaper by it. And believe me, this is a pitch black area, a very pure white glow. And behind that, they could see a 3-inch diameter tree limb that had extended originally over the ring, which had been twisted and broken down 8.5 feet above the ground and was hanging there on the other side of the ring. So they became very frightened. This is just a farm family.
Mm-hmm.
So they went back to the house, and they were so shaken, you know, and they were discussing, well, what should we do? The boy said, Mom, do you have any pictures in your camera? So she goes to the closet, digs out the old Polaroid camera, which is just a Polaroid 411 cheap outfit.
Black and white, yes.
Color.
Okay.
Yeah, this was color. And imagine this. This was 75 ISO, or in those days, ASA film, which is very, very slow.
Right.
The camera operates at F8, which is fairly slow, real slow for nighttime shooting.
Right.
As a matter of fact, I have the camera, and I have done some experiments with it to try to duplicate this for a number of reasons. But she did not put the flash unit on it because she had no flash bulbs. But this thing was glowing brightly, so she thought, well, I'll try it. She's now 80 years old. And as sharp as anything. And I asked her, I said, as you stood there with the camera, getting ready to photograph this ring, now this was minutes after the object had left.
Mm-hmm.
I said, could you see anything around you? I was trying to determine how bright this glow was. And she said, oh, yeah, I can see my husband and my son standing to my left, and I can easily see to adjust the camera. So she takes a Polaroid photo of this ring glowing within minutes of the ascent of the object. Now, that doesn't happen very often. It is truly an astonishing thing to see. So after she takes the picture, they go back in to let it develop. Being now really curious, they go back to the site, and she and her husband squat down by the ring, and they both touch the soil, the glowing soil. And they both said that it had a glassy, sort of tiny cratered feel to it. And it was cool. It was not at all warm. And suddenly, Irma notices that her fingertips are numbing. And she brushes her hand against her trouser leg, her slacks, trying to rub this stuff off. And her leg underneath the slacks goes numb. And at the same time, Mr. Johnson is experiencing the same numbing effect on his hand. The numbing effect lasted for Mr. Johnson, who had tough, calloused hand, about 3 days. And Mrs. Johnson, and she was a nurse, she could not even take pulses for almost 3 weeks because of this numbing effect. And today, this was in 1971, today at 80, that portion of her leg is still numb. She can't, for example, feel a needle if you shove it into it, and so on. It just gets a little better. The next day, the sheriff learns of it from Minneapolis, and he comes out and he takes a magnificent photo of this white encrusted ring. The soil at the center is perfectly normal. Only the ring surface, which is varies from about 1 foot to about 2.5 feet in width, and the ring is slightly elongated, and the widest section of the ring is along the flight path out of the site, which makes a lot of sense.
This is an amazing story.
Oh, it is.
To what point were you called in to the scene?
Well, unfortunately, as it was in those days, the Salina Journal learned of the case, and Salina is about, I don't know, 50 miles from Delphos. And they went out and they took a whole lot of photographs, fortunately, and did a pretty serious article on the sighting. But unfortunately, it took us quite a long while to get hold of it because a friend of a gentleman that Alan Hynek knew in Ohio lived in Salina. He clipped out the article. He sent it to the friend in Ohio. And a couple of weeks later, he sent it to Allen. And immediately, Allen called the sheriff and talked to him. And then called me and says, please, head out there. And so I got there. It was almost 4 weeks after the event.
Mm-hmm. Now, which state is this in again?
In Kansas.
In Kansas, okay.
Now, the interesting thing about this site, generally, if you mm-hmm. go to a landing site a month after the fact, you'll not see very much. For example, when I investigated the Langenberg case, I was up there about 3 weeks after the event, and there had been, they estimated, 4,000 people through the fields. So I didn't get to see a whole lot except for the RCMP's photos. At any rate, when I got out there, it had been snowing that evening, and as I drove up to the farm, the temperature was up in the low 40s, and the snow was melting. And after I had talked with the boy and the father and the mother, and we went out to the site, the ground was just a bog. I mean, it was, well, it was adjacent to a hog pen. And it was in a shelter belt where there was no vegetation. And so I was looking for waders. But anyway, with all of this ground sopped, standing water everywhere, I walk out there, and here is this perfect ring of snow. The snow is all gone in the central area and all around it, and here's this ring beautifully outlined. So I grabbed a bunch of shots of that.
So the ring is covered in snow.
Yes, where it's the only thing that was.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only thing that was. And what becomes more astonishing is that I walked to the ring after doing a lot of quick photography, and I bend down there, and I scoop the snow off of the soil surface, and the soil, the ring soil, is light brown and as dry as an automobile hood. And I couldn't believe this because everything is standing water all around here. So I melted some snow in my hand and I poured it onto the ring soil, and it simply went into individual beads as though you'd poured water on a freshly waxed automobile.
So the dirt then is becoming like water resistant?
Was absolutely water resistant. It was totally hydrophobic and totally dehydrated. The thing that became even more fascinating was, as I took samples in half-inch increments, I thought, well, this is never going to end. I brought back 15 pounds of soil from just the ring in half-inch increments because this effect went 14 inches into the ground.
Whoa.
And suddenly, at 14 inches, it turns into normal black soil. And, of course, this soil would not. I tried all kinds of experiments to produce plant growth in it. And, obviously, if it won't absorb water, plants are not going to grow in it.
What's it missing?
What we have determined from analysis, and some very high-powered analysis, really, and the last very thorough up-to-date testing was just finished in December of last year. And what has been found is that, evidently, this glowing spray that I mentioned coming from the object, building up on the surface of the soil, being absorbed into the soil somehow, as it permeated the soil, it totally dried out everything that it touched, and it also left a coating on the soil. And the laboratories that we've worked with were able to get us electron microscopic photos at like 250,000 magnification showing the coating on a piece of the soil, and crystalline icicle-like structures inside that coating, making up that coating, which Oak Ridge Laboratories had never seen before. The problem was that the labs were not capable of distinguishing what this coating substance was. And everybody was saying, well, get this to NASA. They could do it. And NASA wouldn't even talk to us.
Well, geez, now there's a surprise.
Yeah, oh, yeah, well, yeah, we were very surprised, yeah.
Oh, yes, because but, Lord knows NASA thrives on looking at anomalous data that might even be vaguely related to space activity.
Yeah, well, you know, there's the problem. There's the thing that aggravated me so much about Sagan was that he and people like him would make these statements, well, nobody has shown me any evidence. Well, they don't look.
Yeah, well, exactly.
And we have tried. We have approached everyone, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, you know, and we have tried to get some of this stuff looked at. They won't touch it.
Anyone who takes a look at any of their response to Cydonia, to astronaut supposed sightings, you can figure that if it gets down to actual hardcore evidence, they're certainly not going to take a look at it. What do you see as the most common trace evidence? You've investigated over 2,000 trace cases. What is the predominant, what's the one thing you expect to see when you check a trace?
Well, I can put it this way. The events are consistent enough, even back in the late 70s, I could go in on a new case and talk to the witnesses, not having seen the site at all or having any description of it, have them describe the object and basically how it came in, how it left, or whatever they saw. And when I walked to that site, I already had a very close idea of what that site would look like.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on the type of object, I mean, really, it's that consistent. And that's what I'm trying to show in this research as I get the data all compiled. And this, by the way, will be available at a website on the Internet. They're starting on it tomorrow, as a matter of fact. But I unfortunately can't give you the address right now.
Well, as soon as you get it, we'll pass it on to our listeners. And I'm really looking forward to seeing that. You took 5,000 cases and reduced them down to about 2,200.
Right, and that number will come on down some more, because what I'm trying to do is I've eliminated all of the cases where a site that seems to fit the pattern was found but no object was seen, and I've eliminated all the crop circle business.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're getting down to the good cases.
Good, because that's what we need. And then we can turn around to them and say, hey, 2,200 of these guys, come on, smarten up. We have several calls lined up. Do you mind if we take a couple here, Ted?
Oh, that'd be great.
Okay. On the 1-800 number is Michel Deschamps. Good evening, Michel.
Hi, Errol. Hi, Ted.
And hi.
I'm Mike.
Hey, Michel. How are things up in our quasi-frozen tundra?
Oh, I wish it was a little bit better. This is actually the first time I actually got to hear you guys. I couldn't get on the show at all. I couldn't tune in. My media player was overloaded, apparently, I guess.
The powers that be here at the station are working on that, we understand, and that'll be good when all of that is taken care of. And
yes.
We can have 10,000 people in the audience.
Absolutely.
So what do you have for Ted Phillips, Michel?
Well, Ted, the first time I actually saw you on any documentary, actually I believe it was the only time I ever saw you on a documentary, was a copy of UFOs Are Real, which I purchased from Stanton Friedman.
Yes.
And I still think that of all the documentaries that I have in my collection, that still stands out as being, you know, a really good one.
Well, thanks.
One of the aspects of the UFO phenomena is actually the landing cases, because Arrow knows this. I mentioned several times, I've mentioned, you know, I can't figure these people out who are putting the abduction cases in the forefront as a means to prove the reality of UFOs when they could simply start at square one with the landing cases.
Absolutely right.
And then, you know, landing cases then followed by landing cases with the little occupants standing next to the ship.
Yes.
And then you go on further and say, well, what about the cases where they're actually seen taking rock samples and plant samples and possibly eventually cattle samples and human samples?
Yes, that's absolutely true. And I more than ever have found the need to approach a landing trace event much in the same way police would approach a murder, because you know, you can determine a great deal by looking at the residue, at the remnants. The material has to be sampled and documented in the proper way. As a very end result, you have to have access to laboratories that can do the job.
Right.
And because we don't really know what we're looking for. I keep hoping that I'll find an oil leak or maybe a little fuel leak or something that we can pin something down with, you know.
On the subject of labs that'll do the work, we're very fortunate here in Toronto, York University. We have a good friend there who is well connected into all kinds of labs around Canada if they can't handle it at York University. So when we do get interesting stuff, then it can go to Nick Balaskas up there at York. If you feel so inclined, get in touch if you have something that needs to be looked at, and we'll put you in touch with Nick.
Excellent.
Okay.
Excellent.
That's all I wanted to say. And
Ted, if people like Michelle need to get a hold of you, do you publish your email address publicly?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Sure.
Well, how about giving it out now?
It is Theo, that's T-H-E-O, 2042, at gte.net.
That's Theo, T-H-E-O, 2042, at gte.net.
Yes, and I would love to hear from anyone that has any information on any physical trace event.
Michelle, thanks for your call.
Okay. Thank you, Michelle.
You're welcome, and keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye, guys.
Good night, Michelle. Thanks.
Good night.
And joining us at 872-1010 is Robert. Robert, good evening.
Good evening, guys. How are you? What I'm angry is that the scientific community hasn't really taken, the majority of the scientific community hasn't taken a major part in the investigation of the UFO phenomena. I mean, come on. I mean, it's been going on for 50 years. I mean, there's been UFO sightings all over the place. I mean, too many reports from all over the world. There's physical evidence more so than I thought there originally was, and Mr. Phillips has pointed out, has enlightened me upon tonight. I mean, it's been going on for so long. There is something going on. We have, like, a tremendously vast mystery in front of us. And we have to take, I mean, there has to be more organized efforts, more scientific research put into this to find out what's really going on.
And, well, you do that preliminary reading about the subject.
Yeah.
Just what you can do in any public library, anywhere, mm-hmm. you know, in the Western world.
That's true.
And you start going, if all of these people testified against me in court, I'd be in big trouble.
Yeah.
Well, isn't that good enough to get mainstream science to give this a serious investigation?
Yeah. And also a lot of the thing is that the general public isn't really educated enough about the subject, and the media also, they've been conditioned to think that a lot of these UFO reports are from kooks, and a lot of it's just planes and stars that people miss. You know,
well, yeah, but that's changing, Robert.
That
you must admit, yeah, I mean, Mike Woods and I are sitting here on CFRB 1010 talking UFOs.
Yeah, I guess that's one of the things. Yeah, I think it is slowly changing.
Yeah, I'd say that's a pretty big change, and, you know, this isn't the CFRB your father knew type of thing. I mean, you know, even if it was on a small secondary station, this would be a big step forward.
Exactly.
But
I mean,
to be on, as far as I'm concerned, the authoritative voice in this country in radio, that says a lot about how far we've come.
10, 15 years ago, you probably wouldn't have seen a show like this.
Or heard one either.
Yes.
Well, you know, Robert is right on the money. However, I think a lot of the blame lies with the UFO groups themselves.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, there is a tendency to pursue the sensational, and the guy who claims his family was abducted and cannibalized by aliens will get the coverage. So the thing that I've tried to do, and now that I have funding, that's the key.
Yeah.
Never before have I had any meaningful funding. At one point, Alan Hynek and I managed to get a $4,000 grant. Now, if you can imagine how many trips you can take, even back in the 70s, with $4,000, but it did get us to a number of sites. What I'm interested in is making known what I'm dealing with. I don't care about the abductions. I don't care about an aerial sighting that could have all kinds of explanations.
Yeah.
What we're talking about in the trace cases, very quickly, 35% of all these cases involving a landed or nearly landed object and physical residue of some kind, 35% involve two or more witnesses. 32% of these cases take place in daylight. 44% have a duration, an observation duration of 10 to 20 minutes. And actually 5% at an hour to 2 hours. And 80% of the witnesses were within 30 meters of the object.
That's the kind of stuff we really got to look for.
It is because, you know, we're talking about observations where the object is in a position where people actually know where the object is located. It's sitting there on the ground or a foot above the ground, and they have all kinds of landmarks behind it and around it. So you're eliminating weather balloons, stars, satellites, etc. Yeah. And in a period of 10 to 20 minutes, anyone could recognize the Goodyear blimp if it was sitting there. And yet these people come away with no way to describe these things. They are so removed from anything they have ever seen before. And even those cases wouldn't be worth a dime in the scientific realm if they did not have physical residue left behind.
Mm-hmm.
Because you would then have another visual observation, which to a scientist is worthless, shouldn't be, but it is. And in this case, you have something that remains to be measured, sampled, photographed, and studied long after the object is gone.
And our guest tonight, Ted Phillips, has 2,200 of these. Robert, thank you very much for calling CFRB 1010. Good night. So, Ted, anything that you want to just get in there in the last two or three minutes?
There is kind of a misnomer out there about radiation, where these things have been. And out of all these thousands of cases, less than 1% have involved any kind of radiation. It does happen occasionally, but not often.
Mm-hmm.
I would point out that what I am concentrating on at this point, as far as evidence at landing sites, I'm really making a push to acquire some of the fluid or liquid that is occasionally found at these things. I think that would be an enormous clue, and the luminous material, which I'm hoping to be able to gather up and get into a laboratory still in the glowing state. And I'm actually going beyond that in the idea that we may never prove the extraterrestrial idea or any other idea by dirt samples and plant samples alone. I've become involved in what I term archaeoanomalies. These are indeed strange things, and I've been working on a project. I actually started in 1970 on this in a far Eastern Europe country, which is difficult to get to, and it is the most incredible case that a person could imagine, and it could involve the finding of a nearly complete artifact.
Oh, really? And you tell us this in the last 3 minutes?
Yes.
Once I can tell you the entire story, you'll understand why I can't get into a lot of details right now.
Okay, well, when you can, you'll have to come back and tell us, okay?
I'll put it this way. Of all the things that I've done relating to any kind of research, this single event is the most important, potentially.
Really?
Yes, and I'm very, very excited about it. Hopefully, we'll have some news in the next couple of months.
Okay, well, when you have the news, Ted Phillips, please come back and tell us about it. I know you're going to go to Rents and a couple of other places, but do come back to us as well.
I certainly will. I've enjoyed this, really.
We have, too. And we would love to cover off the other,
2,198 cases I think we have left to talk about. Ted, I got to tell you something that when Errol told me who our guest was and what he was doing in research-wise, I went, physical trace? Well, there's Socorro, and then there's Socorro, and then
which,
what is
by
there?
The way, you is know? An excellent case.
Well, it's an excellent case, and here's the good old Lonnie, police officer Lonnie, who actually had enough guts to come forward and talk about it.
Yes.
But I just want to say thank you very much for pointing out that amidst all of the wing nuts and the crazies that this field tends to attract, and it's the nature of the beast,
yes,
that there's somebody out there doing some real hardcore, read 'em and weep, these are the numbers and the numbers aren't lying kind of research. And so I want to thank you very much for joining us tonight. It's been great.
Yeah, thank you, Ted. It's really been good. And that is a very firm invitation to come back and join us once you can tell us about this Eastern European case. Ted's email address, very quickly, is Theo, T-H-E-O, 2042 at gte.net. And that's this week's look at Strange Days Indeed. You can email us. The address is sdi@cfrb.com. Our thanks to Mark of the Magic Fingers in the control room.
Strange Days Indeed is a co-production of WT Fit, the Random Factory Producers Group, and
executive producer is Gene Mascardelli.
The producer is Errol Bruce Knapp.
Join us again next week. He's Michael J. Woods.
And he's Errol Bruce Knapp.
And this is CFRB 1010. Good night.